Good evening. This is Mitch Miller. Seated around my table here at Sardi's East are three gentlemen who represent the very latest trends in American entertainment. I think you'll enjoy hearing what they have to say. Stu Metz, may we have their names, please?
You bet you may, Mitch. Thank you. This is the Mitch Miller Show, 45 minutes of freewheeling conversation from the New York theatrical restaurant Sardi's East. And joining Mitch's private party this evening are these lively figures of the entertainment scene. The brilliant nightclub and television comic, Jonathan Winters, whose original flow of wit, complete with sound effects, may be heard on the new Verve record album, Here's Jonathan. The Academy Award-winning movie maker, Jerome Hill, producer, director, writer, and designer of the forthcoming Louis de Rochemont comedy fantasy, The Sandcastle. And best-selling novelist, Al Morgan, now New York editor of the exciting new entertainment magazine, Show Business Illustrated. And you'll meet them all after this brief message from Standard Brands.
Pure coffee nectar, that's what's been missing. Missing in your instant coffee, new instant taste and Sanborn has. Pure coffee nectar.
Enjoy the richness of the pure coffee nectar in new Instant Chasen Sanborn. The rich new instant from Chasen Sanborn. Fine coffee for nearly 100 years.
And now here are Jonathan Winters, Jerome Hill, Al Morgan, and radio's most listened to host of the famous and the fascinating, the Beard himself, Mitch Miller.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. As far as new trends go in the comedy branch of entertainment, probably the most original one is the wildly imaginative and wonderful wit of Jonathan Winters. Dayton, Ohio's prescription for a troubled world. Now tell me, Jonathan, just to kick things off here, how do they feel about you and your brand of topical humor back there in Dayton these days? Do you ever get any reports from home?
I was just home a couple of weeks ago, Mitch. I went out there to do an unusual little stint. I went out to MC the World War I pilot's dinner, I guess it was luncheon, I'm sorry, luncheon. And it was kind of fun. I looked at it as more of a historical thing than as for comedy, because this will probably be the last time these guys will get together. They had one man there, Brigadier General Folloy, I think, who learned to fly through correspondence. And which I thought was kind of an unusual way to fly, you know. Page 16, you know, pull back on stick and release. But he was quite a guy. And, of course, Captain Eddie Rickenbacker was the guy who put this thing together. And then they flew the old planes.
Yes, I saw a newsreel of that. Yeah. Did they actually fly them?
There was one man there, actually 71 years old, who flew Spad or one of the Newports or something. And to see the Jennies fly, you know, it's kind of a kick.
Yes.
So I was back home, and I saw several friends. I was only in Dayton for about 48 hours, but I get back from time to time.
Nobody crosses the street when they see you coming.
Well, I hide in alleys. And I have a very dark taxi pick-me-up.
Hello, Morgan. Nice to see you here again and in the new role of magazine editor. Tell me, though, Al, does this mean that you've had to give up your career as novelist after such bestsellers as The Great Man and One Star General?
I hope not, Mitch. I'm very lucky because I have one in the bank, which will be out in September. I have another one in the typewriter, which I don't think I'll ever get back to. But presumably, I guess I'll go back to what I did when I started writing. When I did The Great Man, I was still working at CBS, and I hit it over weekends and at night, and I guess I'm back to that routine again.
And the next story will be about a magazine editor. Sure.
I have X number of dollars a year in first rights to you, Hefner, in the Playboy story.
And Jerome Hill, I've been reading the advance material on your new comedy fantasy movie, The Sandcastle, and the picture sounds as delightful as the Alec Wilder score for it, which we've recorded in a Columbia album. It also sounds like quite a change of pace from your Academy Award-winning documentary, Albert Schweitzer. Which reminds me, did you ever hear from Schweitzer how he liked the picture, Jerry?
Oh, his own picture?
Yes.
Yeah, I did. He loved it. I sat with him when we went to the French preview in Strasbourg, and he got a big kick out of it. He loved it. He ended up practically making that picture, you know. I claim I said I was director of it, but by the time we were through with it, he was directing the whole thing himself.
I guess that's what he does with everything.
Yes, he does. He takes over.
Well, I know you also recorded Schweitzer's organ music for Columbia
and
France.
That's right.
Was there any special recollections about that?
Well, that was really quite a seance. I use that as kind of a bribe to persuade him to have a film. He didn't want to have a film. He was against it. And finally, by putting up a recording equipment in his little church and in a place that he could go over and play the organ at any time of day or night when he felt like it, he fell for the idea, and he loved it, and then he decided he'd like to work with Eric Anderson and me and make a film.
Well, it must make a pretty awe-inspiring sight to watch him at the organ.
Oh, yes, he's wonderful.
And that Wallace
he comes, yeah. And you know, when people go there to see him, he'd like to give everybody a 20-minute talk and a walk down the road, but he can't do that. So he takes them all over to the church and plays the organ to them.
Well, tell me this. How does he manage to get around those pedals fast? Because you have to work fast in those.
Well, organs. He's still in shape. Yeah. You know, even when he's down there in Africa, he practices on a piano that has pedals so that it'll be the same reflex as his organ.
Can't you hear it sing along with Al Schweitzer?
Yeah.
Well, Jonathan, what is... I was wondering, do you have any observations on Schweitzer, Africa, or organ music? Anything come to your fertile mind?
I can suddenly see, I can see the organ, rather than made out of brass, you know, made out of ivory tusks. he hits the chords, you know, boom, boom. Sort of wild sounds.
You mean an elephant is the bass sound? And then...
I imagine if you hit an elephant, a pretty good one. you get enough for a half-hour show there, you know. Trampling the poor gun bearers and everything.
Tickling the ivories.
Yeah, tickling the ivories.
Can I drop a Schweitzer story in here?
Please do.
Norman Cousins, who is to Al Schweitzer as Peter Martin is to a Hollywood star, made the pilgrimage over to Lamoureux to see Schweitzer, and he came back with, I think, a funny story that maybe I should check with you since you've been there. But he said while he was there, there were two vehicles on the island. There was a 1926 Chevrolet and a 1931 Pontiac, which were the only two vehicles on the island. And Norman said the wonderful thing happened while he was there. The inevitable happened. They collided.
Jonathan Winters, in your latest record album, Here's Jonathan, you range over a variety of topics and with a variety of voices and sound effects. In fact, it's hard to tell your imitations from the real thing. How about showing what I mean with a sound, say, of a jet plane from that bit entitled Test Flight?
No, I don't think I'll do that. It's a
lot of an elephant being hit, all right?
Don't you love a guy for that, though?
Yeah.
You're all set up with the one thing there, and you're going to... No, I... Well, the jet is a guy who might sit in the thing and say, well, Charlie, I guess it's time to take off, isn't it?
I guess it is. We've been waiting here about 12 hours, folks, and as you can see, the weather's clear, and the only thing that's holding us up is we just haven't gotten no okay.
Brilliant, Charlie. Brilliant. Well, everybody, fasten your belts and... We're heading right for the tower. You folks with cameras now. We're going to really scare that guy for the first time.
That's beautiful. You know, talk about waiting. I've done a lot of waiting at airports lately. I guess the weather's been pretty bad, you know. They have to turn them around. They don't want to leave any jet on the ground for a spare, you know.
That's right.
I guess every minute on the ground is lost dough. Another imitation of yours that breaks me up is the voice of the robot.
Oh, the guy that talks like this that comes down from outer space and it...
And he's the robot and says, I almost forget my own stuff.
Stick around, it'll be on a pause show.
Well, the guy says, why, they're coming at us. It is a robot. You're not going to hurt us, are you? Look, we're Americans. We've got enough people against us. Don't hurt us.
No, I'm not here to hurt you. All I want is a woman.
Woman, well, let's see, I don't know. I used to know a couple of guys over at Univac.
Well, I don't want a brain. I want a body.
And he gets back into his saucer and...
Brilliant. Now, Al Morgan, I don't have to ask you to imitate an editor getting up out the first edition of a new entertainment magazine.
Johnny's just done it.
Since that's what you're actually in the process of doing now, when's the first issue of Show Business Illustrated, Al, and what will it feature?
Well, it's due on the stands, Mitch, on August 23rd. And I think to tell you what it features, I'd have to go back and tell you some of the concepts behind the magazine. I think that in terms of today's market, when you bring anything new out, particularly a magazine, you have two basic questions you have to answer. Is there a need and is there a lack? And I think that if anybody is interested in show business per se, there are many specialized magazines that cover special areas. But there has been, strangely enough, no magazine which covers the entire spectrum. And we will cover everything from movies, plays, nightclubs, television, radio, I suppose circuses, fairs, I suppose... In a sense, the presidential press conference today is show business. I suppose the World Series is show business when it's put on closed-circuit television. So the spectrum is very wide. And what we're going to try to do, Mitch, is to cover all of the areas. And we take our title, Show Business Illustrated, very seriously. It will be a very heavily illustrated magazine. We have, for instance, in terms of photography, we have people like Dick Avedon, who is working with us on a yearly contract and will be, to all intents and purposes, our portrait photographer. We will use photographers like Jean Mealy, Cartier-Bresson, Dennis Stock, Bert Stern. In the pictorial issue also, we will, in many cases, go beyond photographs. To give you an illustration of the first issue, we have a nostalgic piece by Mark Connelly called Miracle on 47th Street, which is his personal reminiscence of the opening night of Green Pastures. Mm-hmm. Now, in illustrating this, it would have been obvious and relatively easy to dig out of the files a picture of the cast in the original production. Instead, we assigned an artist to do a double truck, two-page oil of this, which we felt was in keeping with the kind of classic figure of the story. We will, from time to time, use that kind of illustration, but what we will try to do is to tell anybody interested in show business and all its aspects every 2 weeks what's going on, what's good, what's bad, and I think it's going to be a rather hip, bright magazine without being either a fan magazine at one end or Variety on the other. Mm-hmm. And I think it's going to be very good. I'm prejudiced, but I think it's going
to
be very
good. Sounds marvelous. Well, I see the Philip Morris people would like to break in here with a few words, but I'll be back with more questions right after their message.
Who did it? How did they do it? What in the world did they do? Who put the men in them tall smoking?
Alpine, that's who. Alpine, that's who.
Nice.
Now, the menthol cigarette has tobacco flavor a man can get hold of. Alpine always tastes rich, never smokes rough. Alpine filter cigarette.
Nice.
Jonathan Winters, I dared not go on until I ask you, how does the idea of a new entertainment magazine strike you?
Well, it certainly strikes me as a fantastic new frontier. And, Mr. Morgan, as you know, I have any number of friends in show business. And I think that this is going to, again, open a great gap that and a sort of a deeper understanding of what the devil goes on in front of the lights and in back of the lights. And I hope that I'll... be in one of your issues sooner or later. If not, I could very well close the magazine up.
We have, this magazine being a Playboy magazine, the obvious question I'm always asked is, how are you going to get the girl that folds out into Show Business Illustrated? And this may solve Johnny's problem. Mm-hmm. Thinking of a feature of a picture of a comic, and it's our special fold-out thing, and it doubles as a dartboard, Johnny. And, after that, you've been tapped.
No, that's one of the reasons I quit the clubs. I felt that I was being a dartboard there. But
the darts were a little wetter
and heavier.
But Jerome Hill, I understand the Sandcastle, which you wrote, produced, and directed, employs some novel film techniques, including a puppet sequence that you did the artwork for yourself. What kind of puppets are they, Jerome, and how are they used?
Well, puppet is the wrong word. They're cut-out figures. What I was faced with, Mitch, there's a kid in this picture who has to fall asleep and dream. And he's been surrounded all day on the beach by a lot of crazy people. Well, you know the kind of people you see on a beach.
Yeah.
And then he goes to sleep. There's a rainstorm that drives everybody away. And he goes to sleep and he dreams about them. And he's seen them in all their little situations and problems. But all of their little plots have been cut off by this rainstorm. So when he goes to sleep, he continues all their stories in his dream. So what I did was to make little drawings of them. According to the... I don't know if you ever saw those English cutout theaters that kids used to play with. They were called Pollocks or Penny Plain, tuppence-colored things. And I animated them with stop-frame animation. And they looked pretty much like funny papers. You know, mm-hmm. it's not a Disney-type animation. It's less naturalistic, let's say.
Well, it must have taken an awful long time to do.
Well, that actually did take a long time. The live part took about 4 weeks to film, and this took about a year to film.
Tell us something about the little boy and girl who play the lead, Barry and Laurie Caldwell.
That's right. They're kids that I knew out in California, and they're... the boy himself took direction. I mean, he knew what he was doing. He knew he was in a film. But his little sister, of course, had no idea what was happening. I couldn't get her to do anything. I mean, she wasn't directed at all, except he would direct her. I finally said to him, now listen, you got to handle this girl. You know her. She's your sister.
And she just had a gallbladder operation.
And she just had a gallbladder. Quite right. So we just opened the camera up and let her do whatever she did. But she turned out. She turns out better than he is, as a matter of fact.
Mm-hmm. Well, and how did he happen to get the composer, Alec Wilder, to land an acting part in the picture, too?
Well, that's like Eddie Schweitzer to play the organ.
Yeah. I see. You wanted
to get a movie. Well, it was kind of a... I don't know. I think Alec's kind of a show-off anyway. And he comes through as a wonderful fisherman. And he's funny and he's pretty convincing. But actually, I didn't use any straight actors all the way through. They're all people that I think are talented. And they all do their little bits. And... it adds up, I think, to a film.
Well, Alec had some experience making some prize-winning movies. Follow the House of Usher, you know, he helped
right,
make that.
Right.
With Dr. Sibley Watson.
I remember very well.
Oh,
well, he has a great film sense.
Well, gentlemen, I see we have some other business coming up again, but we'll be back shortly after this message from General Motors.
Bergen, why did you stop the car here?
I want to talk to that farmer.
Oh, mister... Oh, you call me?
Why, it's Mortimer Smith.
Oh, where? Oh, that's me.
Are there any General Motors dealers around here?
No, but we got some Chevrolet, Pontiac, Oldsmobile, Buick, and Cadillac dealers, though. And some Chevy and GMC truck dealers, too.
Well, Mortimer, those are all General Motors dealers.
No! Well, what do you want to see them all for?
Well, I only want to see one for Guardian maintenance.
Do they make that car, too?
No, that's a service that's available only at General Motors dealers' service departments.
Oh, I see.
Yes. And right now, they're featuring complete lubrications, quality appearance services, brake adjustments, and front-end inspections. It's quality work performed by GM-trained servicemen at a fair price.
Oh, that makes good sense even to me.
This is the Mitch Miller Show from the theatrical restaurant Sardi's East in New York. And we'll rejoin Mitch and his guests, Jonathan Winters, Al Morgan, and Jerome Hill, after the usual pause for station identification. This is the CBS Radio Network.
This is CBS in Fort Wayne, WANE. A visit to our national parks is an exciting adventure all the family will enjoy. The snow-clad majesty of Mount Rainier, the fabulous falls of Yosemite, the rock-bound coast of Maine. Wherever you go, the scenery is grand. But there is one aspect of our national parks that comes close to being a national disgrace. And that is the careless littering of those beauty spots, the thoughtless tossing of trash just anywhere on roads and trails and campsites. Last summer, every visitor to a national park left an average of 2 pounds of litter behind. Every tissue, every can or carton, every paper cup, every litter bit hurts. So wherever you go this summer to a national park or your own hometown park, think before you throw. Think how you'd like that park to look and stash your trash in the car litter bag, the nearest litter barrel, or take it out with you. That's how you can help keep America clean and beautiful. Time right now, 7:30. Stay tuned for Mitch Miller.
once again from Sardis East in New York, here are Jonathan Winters, Jerome Hill, Al Morgan, and your host, Mitch Miller.
Thank you very much, Mitch. Jerome Hill, you've certainly stuck with a quality approach to your filmmaking, not only with Sandcastle and Schweitzer, but also things like your documentary color short on Grandma Moses. I was wondering if you happen to have any revealing Grandma Moses stories left over from the time that you shot the picture, Jerry.
Well, she's... You know, she's 101 now. But you can hardly believe. I've always liked the scene, the story when I showed her picture, when we got all through building, making it. She didn't really know what we were doing, I'm sure. I'm sure she didn't realize there was going to be a picture. But finally, I'd used a lot of her paintings and had kind of jazzed them up and moved the camera around, almost animated them. And we took a copy of it up and showed it to her, and she sat there. And she just couldn't get over it. And her comments were, look at her now. Well, what's she going to do now? Well, there she is picking flowers. Well, look at that. And what's she doing now? In other words, she saw herself as somebody else completely. And I find that's very true of a lot of people. They, when they see themselves in pictures or hear their voices, they can't believe that's the real thing.
Sure, until I got used to it, you know, on television, I was always a third pitched higher than I thought I was. Now I'm down here now. Speaking of Grandma Moses, as we have been, our new album reminds me once again that, your new album, I should say, reminds me once again that among your many talents, you're absolutely topped at vocal imitations of spry old ladies, 101 or, and over and younger. Take that one that you bill as the oldest airline stewardess. Who is she again?
That's Maud Frickert. She's just slightly under 100. She's in the 90 bracket, you know, between 90 and 100.
How does she sound?
She sounds just about like she would. She's the type of woman that says, yes, I am the oldest living airline stewardess. And me and my brother, Lamar Jean. One day he come up to me and he says, Muddy? Always called me Muddy. He says, I feel as if I want to fly today. Well, he'd been hospitalized, I guess, at least a half a dozen times for trying to fly. At any rate, we went on back out of the house there, and he went up. He'd do strange things. He'd walk up to a cow and say, Hi, Mr. Dog. That's why we used to keep him around cutting the grass a lot. Oh, every once in a while he'd go down to the store, you know, for a loaf of bread, but that was all. Somebody'd have to watch him. At any rate, he stood up back there on Willard's Bluff. It was a real sunny day. He was 42 at the time, handsome man, built like gangbusters. And so he stood up there and he says, I'm going to fly, Muddy. I says, don't repeat yourself. Go ahead. And what he'd done was he'd scotch-taped about 165 pigeons to his eye. And he got a running start. And he was airborne for like about 15 seconds. And then some kid throwed a bag of popcorn in a stone car and he bashed his brains out.
You know, I've got one for superlatives, but I'm convinced, I mean, I have been, but more than ever, that this is the funniest man in the whole world. Really, I just, because you, the way, the knack of telling a story is nobody has it anymore. Everyone depends on punchlines, but the way you tell a story is hilarious, and the
content is so
Mitch,
when you get off the air, ask Johnny to do a couple of other ones.
Johnny, when you started dabbling in voices like turtles, robins, and creaking doors, I was wondering if it ever got you into trouble, say, with school principals and so forth.
Well, to tell you the truth, Mitch, I was in trouble anyway. I was always a guy that had a mental block and still does with regard to mathematics. I was really not thick. I was dumb. And I have a man now who does all my bookwork, who keeps me out of Sing Sing and some of the better cement castles.
Lenny Bruce.
Yeah. But I often go back and I kid about it, but it's true. I flunked clay class. And but I go back to the teacher saying, if I give you 3 apples and 2 apples, how many do you have, John?
and I'd pause for an hour and say, 7? You know, frantically, 12. No, no, 5, John. And this was terrible. I stayed with fruit for a long time. pears and grapes, you know. But it was a terrible thing. But I did these little sounds, not in school. I was fighting so hard to stay in school that there were really very few times I gave the teacher a hard time. Mm-hmm. And I ended up alone doing a lot of solitary work, sitting there in detention, of course, for making faces. I did a lot of takes. Mm-hmm. And when the teacher's back was turned and things like that, I was guilty of. But I wasn't really basically a troublemaker in school. There were only a handful of times. I did most of my little goodies outside in the playground. And I did sounds a lot because I was an only child. I played a lot by myself and rather enjoyed it for the first 12 years. And I had one other little playmate across the street, and he and I got together and did all kinds of little sounds and things. But most of my characters I've gotten from life, really. They were, the Grandma Frickert was a conglomeration of a lot of older women that I've known. Some relatives that rubbed off, you know, and the characters I met in the service and on buses and in terminals and trains and planes, they were people taken from real life.
But they're all universal. That's the amazing part of it, you know. We all recognize them immediately. Now, Morgan, from what I hear, you didn't have a misspent youth either. They tell me that you went to work in broadcasting at the age of 14. What was your job in those days, Al?
Well, at 14, I was a writer, producer, director, star. I've been trying to live up to it since, Mitch. No, seriously, I did start in radio when I was very young and spent most of my life in radio and then later in television and then got eaten with the whole thing by writing The Great Man.
And Jerome Hill, you're another master of all trades as far as movie making goes, but didn't you start out to be first a musician and then a painter?
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right.
Where did you study your music and art?
Well, I was in the Yale Music School. I majored in music. Mm-hmm. And then went over to Rome and Paris and studied mm-hmm. painting.
And then when did you get interested in filmmaking?
Well, just as soon as I could. That was in the early 30s, when they first made a camera that you could really do things with.
Mm-hmm. And Jonathan Winters, am I mistaken, or isn't your mother a broadcasting personality?
Yeah, she's on a station, WIZE, in Springfield. And she's been in any number of shows, was in Civic Theater, which is known to most of us here, I guess, in the East as Stock. And
what does she?
She has a woman's program, something similar to yours, only from the female angle, and interviews personalities. Of course, she can't get as many as you get here because usually they drop down, you know, by parachute, or a Greyhound bus has a blowout, and she races to the scene, you know, and captures anybody she can. But she's interviewed some tremendous personalities on her program. She's got a little 15-minute radio show. Mm-hmm. So I got a lot of background there of work, and I used to listen to her read plays, you know.
You know, she ought to come to New York, and I'll help her round up some people to interview for her program.
Fine.
I mean it.
All righty.
Bruno, you hear that?
I studied, art. I was interested in listening to these two gentlemen talk about education and background. I was going to become an artist. I studied about 2.5 years. I think that's the longest, really, hunk of education I've had. I, of course, went through high school. I quit when I was 17 and came back. I realized that this was a thing to do. And then I was in college, I always say, for about an hour. But I seriously went to art school for 2.5 years. I was going to become a cartoonist. And I still do a lot of art.
Johnny's also writing a novel. I think you would ask him about that.
Oh, listen, that's embarrassing with people of your caliber surrounded. I am writing a thing called the...
That's why I brought it up, Johnny.
The Iron Clown. And I've been on it for about a year now, and I realize suddenly that how limited I am in many directions. And so that's the reason it's taking me so long. It's sort of an autobiography and some of my feelings on... things in the business and out of the business and the world in general. I'm certainly not an authority on much of anything, but I've thrown in some little verbal gems there and by way of the typewriter.
I can't wait for it, really.
I'm not saying this about Johnny, but one of the things, if you're a working novelist, and you meet people. Everybody in the world figures he has two jobs, whatever he does to make a living and writing books. Everybody feels if he just had the time, he could turn out that best-selling novel. See, and I'm reminded of the time I went up just after I got married to meet my in-laws and to meet the various members of the community in which my wife had grown up, and they threw the inevitable tea party in the afternoon where I was on exhibit. And I remember being presented to the two matriarchs of the community, and I was introduced, and one of them, who may have been Maud Frickett, said in what...
Probably was.
And said, "What does your husband do?" And Martha said, "He's a writer." And a look of terrible dismay came over her face, which lasted a full 30 seconds, and then she said, "Well, that shouldn't be so difficult. There are so many things to write about." And on the bad days, you know, I want to call her up and say, "Name five."
Well, Al, I understand that your previous experience in journalism included a stint as combat correspondent during World War II. What were some of the stories you covered then?
Oh, Mitch, we don't have the time. We don't have the time. I wound up, actually, as the least equipped commando in the American Armed Forces. And I remember coming, arriving on the boat in a little garden spot called Anzio and saying the thing that I think... You know, they said there were no atheists in the foxholes, but there was nobody on a troop ship who didn't sooner or later turn and say, "What am I doing here?" And I remember saying that as we steamed into the Anzio harbor, and the guy next to me looked at me and he said, "What are you complaining about?" And he took a glass eye out. He had one eye. And I said, "What are you doing here?" And he said, "You know what they said to me?" He said, "I went to the doctor and I took the glass eye out and I showed him I had one eye. And I was being sent into combat as an infantryman." And he said, "You know what the doctor said to me?" He said, "You're lucky." He said, "The reason you're lucky is that in combat, it's the split second that makes the difference between life and death." And he said, "The normal soldier has to close one eye to fire his gun." He said, "You don't have to do that."
Oh, oh. Bittersweet.
So much for Buckingham.
Yeah. Well, Jerry Hill, I gather that you had an interesting war assignment. Liaison officer with a famous French fighter squadron... during World War I.
Right. I think I was the only man who spoke French that wasn't sent to Japan.
One of my fellow commandos in basic training was Fokine, the ballet master.
Sure.
Who was then in his 40s, weighed, I guess, on the hoof maybe a fast 200 pounds, whose only comment on the whole army was, you know, I'd say, "Fokine, what do you think of the army?" He'd say, "Fantastic, absolutely fantastic." And we all wound up on our last leave before going overseas, and we were run through the final processing where the corporal, aged 18, went through our credentials to go out and get shot. And he came to Fokine, and Fokine, where it said occupation, had listed his occupation as artiste, with an E on the end. And the corporal said, "You're an artist." And Fokine said, "Of course, all my family have always been artists." And he said, "But you're an artist." And Fokine said, "Sure, I'm an artist." So if Fokine was lifted out and was not sent overseas with us, they put in the word painting sign saying, "To the latrine, this way."
Well, gentlemen, I see we have just another short sponsor message coming up at this point, but we'll be back with more questions and answers after this word from Pensacola.
The lively crowd. They agree, those who think young face have deep clean. They pick the right one, the modern light one. Now it's Pepsi. For those who think young, so go ahead and pick the drink that lets you drink young as you think. Yes, get the right one, the modern light one. Now it's Pepsi. For those who think young.
Well, let's get back to the war a minute. Jonathan Winters, how did it affect your life? You were a combat Marine, weren't you?
Well, I was in combat, but certainly not to the extent the infantryman was, the ground Marine. I was what they call, it's rather an unkind name, but unfortunately we're labeled with it, a seagoing bellhop. I was an anti-aircraft gunner on the Bonhomme Richard, CV-31-554-727. Corporal, last day, March 1st, 1946. That about wraps up my whole thing. I was... I was... was 17 when I went in. I quit high school, and people were calling me yellow and coward, and they said, "You're 5'11 and a half. Why aren't you in? Eddie Bellerton's in. I think that you're a traitor." And I would come home every night from blowing up medicine balls. And, I turned to my mother. I said, "I've got to go. I can't face the people in this city anymore." And everybody's going. She said, "All right, go on." And so I went. I was in 2.5 years, and I was with Task Force 58.
Well, that's
Halsey's third, and we were a night carrier with the Shangri-La and the Yorktown, and ran up and down the islands of Japan, Okinawa, and made our little invasion, strikes, I should say. And then I had 3 days in Japan as the liberator and conquering hero. And managed to sit in the back of a Japanese taxi and drink a bottle of sake.
You get a bath.
Why, yeah. I never got to one of those baths. We rigged up our own little unit. We had empty gasoline cans and punched holes in the bottom of the thing, and then ran a hose in from the top and pulled a little chain, and that was supposed to surprise us. And so it was a cheap thrill. You know? But, you know, when you're enlisted, man, what can you do?
Jonathan, have you incorporated any Marine types into your cast of characters at all?
Well, I have a Marine bit that I put together, which there are a number of characters. As I say, I ran into an awful lot of characters, as I'm sure we all did, that were in the service. And one was a gunnery sergeant, you know, the guy said,
"All right, you guys, you know, shape up or ship out."
And then he would whisk out 7 funny books and... I'll never forget one time speaking. We had this guy. I won't mention his name because he's liable to come out of a wooded area and find me. But he was a crack shot. There wasn't any getting around that. And he was one heck of a Marine. He was a little on the illiterate side. And one day you were speaking about Yale. We had a couple of guys that had flunked out of OCS, and they came down to Paris Island. They were sent there. They didn't, you know, come down on their own. They were sent there, sent to this fun sand pile. And so these two guys were really lost. And we hung out for a short time together. And one day, this guy, a sergeant, came over, and he said,
"What are you reading there, Winters?"
And I said, "Well, I'm reading Dickens." And he said, "What up is in?" And I did a beat, you know, and a take, and I said, "Well, same outfit as Willie Shakespeare." And he said, "Have them in and from my tent by noon." And I tried, you know, very hard to get pictures of those men because I couldn't naturally get them. If I could, I think the war would have ended. But I had little experiences all throughout the war that were unusual. We take up too much time now. I remember one day I was standing on the bridge on the carrier, sort of an unusual story, and there was Admiral Ballantyne, and I was Admiral's orderly, and the fog was so thick you couldn't cut it with a knife. It was night. And we had about maybe 20 planes up, F-6Fs, fighters, and couldn't get them down, and the Admiral turned around to me and he said, "You know where we are, kid?" And I said, "I have no idea, sir," because I didn't, you know. I could tell. I said, "It's kind of chilly. I'll bet we're someplace where it's cold." Typical PFC remark, you know. And we used to see seagulls and know that we were near land, you know, little things like that. That's as close as we could get to top secret reports. He said, "We're 75 miles off the coast of Japan. How about that, boy?" And I disappeared for a while and came back to him. And he said, "We're going to have to make a decision. Turn the lights on. You run down there in the airplot and tell him to turn the lights on." And, of course, that would light us up just like a Christmas tree. And I went down and told them, and they didn't believe me. "Get back upstairs, boy." And used some other words that we couldn't use on the air. And so then the old man came down, and they did turn the lights on, and they got everybody in. But it was kind of a frightening moment in my little...
They all got in.
Career, they all got in.
Amazing story. Joan Hill, another background question for you. I know that you inherited your interest in art, along with the mere masterpieces, from your grandfather, James J. Hill, one of the famous railroad men of American history. In fact, wasn't he called the Empire Builder of the Northwest?
I guess so, yeah.
Does that mean that he had a lot to do with building up the big cities out there, like Seattle and Portland?
Well, I guess he did. I think he... I know that he, when the immigration was coming over with Swedes and Swedish people and Germans and so forth and so on, he would indicate what parts of the country would be, would resemble where they were living, and he would have them bring over their livestock with them, and or else he would be, he had an experimental farm, and his idea was to get people of certain climates that encourage them to stay and continue living in the kind of climates they've been living in.
Makes sense. And no wonder.
It does make sense.
Boy, they got the most beautiful part of the country around Minneapolis. That's all with all those lakes.
That's right.
You know, excuse me, Mitch. Yes. Maybe we could get some people from West Germany to come help us with the New Haven.
Like Werner von Braun.
Well, I have only about 45 seconds. I'll ask Al Morgan, will Show Business Illustrated emphasize constructive criticism as well as articles and photos?
Yes.
Incidentally, will the artwork be as bold as Playboy's at sister publication?
It'll be as bold, but it'll be a little more covered up. The symbol of the magazine, you know, the bunny is the symbol of Playboy for rather obvious reasons. The symbol for our magazine is an owl in top hat with a cane and one eye closed in a wink. And I think this really is what we are taking as our attitude. I think this will be a magazine that will take a rather jaundiced view of the whole entertainment spectrum. We will not knock for the sake of knocking, but at the same time, we will not hesitate to apply a few raps where they're deserved.
Well, gentlemen, the word from CBS is that time has run out on us here at Sardi's East. It's been a real treat talking with you and exploring new avenues in entertainment, and I wish you all the best of luck in your endeavors, pioneering and otherwise. Jonathan Winters, we'll be laughing at your many voices and sounds on television and in the bright new night spots like San Francisco's Hungry Eye, and the name of that wonderful new album, incidentally, is Here's Jonathan on Verve Label. And, thank you for coming, John.
Thank you,
Mitch. I've been for 5 years. I've never caught you on one of these nights. And Jerome Hill, moviegoers are in for a rare experience when the Sandcastle opens soon at the Guild Theater and Rockefeller Center here in New York and elsewhere. Glad you could drop in, Jerry.
Nice to be here, Mitch.
And now, Morgan, it's always good news when the Free Press comes up with a new member, and it looks like Show Business Illustrated will be not only the latest, but the brightest on the newsstands. Thank you for coming. Good luck to both of you, Al. And to my listeners, I'll be back next week at the same time with more people I'm sure you want to meet. Until then, this is Mitch Miller saying good night and have a good week.
The Mitch Miller Show is a production of Merrindell Enterprises in cooperation with the CBS Radio Network and is produced by Bruno Zerato Jr. and directed by Ken Fickett. Summer, you'll be spending more time out of doors. And while you're enjoying the beauty of our countryside, having a picnic in the woods or relaxing at the beach, don't destroy the beauty for everyone else. Don't leave papers lying about. Put them in trash receptacles. Carry a trash bag in your car. Do your bit to keep America beautiful for those who live here and for the tourists visiting from abroad. This is Stuart Metz, inviting you to join the Mitch Miller Show next week at the same time. Tonight's World Music Festival concert from Bergen, Norway, on most stations of the CBS Radio Network.
This is WAAP.